Welcome to Golder Broadcasting Association's Reading and Writing Podcast about books and the authors who write them. Find out not only about their latest book, but also what they write, why they write, and how they work with others so we can read them. Have you ever had the idea that you too wanted to write a book? Find out how it was done by others in candid conversations about what, why, and how they nurtured their books. This episode's interviewer is Jerry Donaldson. Hi everyone, and welcome back to Reading and Writing. This is the third of our interview series with Marion Halliday, author, blogger, compositioner, photographer, and many other things. And we're going to focus on working collaboratively with others. So welcome, Marion. Welcome back to this series and final episode of a podcast focusing on you.
How quickly we've got to the end. Thanks, Jerry, for having me once again on the podcast, and hello to all the listeners out there who've tuned in. I'm looking forward to this episode, not because it's the last one, but because it's something that happened more recently in my writing journey than other things that we've been talking about in the previous episode.
What we're looking at today is working with others. So how we go through a writing process, and whether that's with a co-author or an editor, as opposed to writing for people, like you may have been doing on your blog, or where in the corporate world you write for others, as opposed to working with someone very closely to develop your first book, which was working with an editor. Tell us about that process, how different it was.
My first book, Aussie Loos with Views, was based on a series on my blog looking at scenic public toilets around Australia.
Very relevant to Australia.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, people see me now, just as a little aside, was loo girl. I get photos from people who have seen an interesting loo now, and they immediately think of me. I don't know whether to be insulted or thrilled by that.
I think thrilled.
I go for thrilled. Because who knows, one day there may be another book where I do collaborate with other people. Back in the day when my first published book was in the offing, Aussie Loos with Views was a very different book to what the blog showed. What the blog shows is probably more a lengthy description of not just the loo, but the destination where the loo is found. For the book, however, it was really just a little series of comical snapshots. Here's some interesting loos around Australia that either have a view or are the view because they've got a painting or a mural or something interesting about the architecture or scenic setting outside. When my editor and I first started talking about what the book was going to look at, she envisaged a funny little coffee, well, not a coffee table book in the sense that you're going to, it's more like a funny little book you can stash in your toilet. that every Aussie home should have one about loos. It wasn't ever really meant to be a serious discussion on the purpose of loos in Australia and how the dunny has evolved, or it was just like, look at these funny loos. And so the whole thing was based on more of a comedic entertainment for people who...
And was that what you were directed to do by the editor?
It was what I was directed to some degree. They were basing their assessment of my ability to do it on the fact that I'd already done something like that on my blog. Blog posts were a bit more lengthy than the snippets in the book.
Were you told a certain length?
Yes. The suggestion was to 100 words. When I say suggestion, obviously if I'd written 102 words, it wasn't going to be a problem. The whole point was something that people could flick through and have a bit of a laugh, whereas my blog was more about, hey, look at this scenic toilet. Hey, this is the setting it's in. This is the destination where I saw it. And here's some of the other things you can find. So the purpose of the blog was quite different to the purpose of the book.
Remember you saying that you had about 30 different articles on your blog. Did you choose those, or was that something that they chose saying, we want this one, this one?
The ones on my blog weren't enough. We discussed how many that I hadn't published because they said they were looking for a bit more than that. And one of the other things that we discussed was the spread of loos across Australia. I'm from South Australia. I have, just by default, many more photos of loos of South Australia, some of which are good, but some of which didn't make it into the book because we didn't want it to be overly focused on one state over another. Otherwise, it would lose its national appeal. So people in any state would be able to pick up the book and say, hey, there's 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or from my state in here. And so it had some relevance to a wider range of people. That wasn't something that I'd considered. So working with the editor, it was like, well, oh, that makes sense. If we're looking at saleability, if we're looking at what's going to happen to this book, how many people will be interested in it, it's not aimed at one section of the Australian population. It's aimed at everybody. The smaller states had fewer. I had to then focus on how many good pictures and stories of Lou's I had in every state or territory in Australia.
Did that mean then that you went through all your pictures and you wrote something, 100 words on each of the pictures of the Lou's, and then submit that to the editor?
Yes, that's pretty much how it worked. I chose the toilets that were going to appear, and that was based on the scenicness, I suppose. Is that even a word? I'm not sure. How it looked, whether I had a good photo of it, because there were some really great toilets that didn't make it because it was a dull day, or the photo just didn't do it justice and it didn't look like anything, whereas the real thing does. I didn't want to sell anyone Lou's short. So I used quite a number from my blog, not all of them, and then I had some other photos that I'd been taking over the years that I'd used to make up the difference. In the book there's about 60 toilets, it's not just 30 that were on my blog.
So going from that, obviously you chose 30 to go onto your blog, and then you chose 50, 60 to go into the book. When you were writing for your blog, I presume you did that sequentially. You had a toilet. So was the editing of your own photography work different for writing the book?
I guess with anything, you have to look at the end user of whatever you're producing. The blog, my end user was someone who was interested in travelling in Australia. The end user for the book was someone who might find it funny to read a book about toilets. They didn't necessarily have to be an Aussie traveller, whereas to read my blog, the chances are good that they would be wanting to travel in Australia and they were looking for some inspiration. The toilet book isn't inspiration unless you want to do a toilet tour of Australia, in which case...
Fair enough, you can travel all around,
yeah,
and,
that's
and mark off each one you have a piddle in.
Exactly.
I suppose, do you in fact have to consider the idea of two audiences when you're actually writing with an editor? Because you have an intent for the reader, but you have to supply and then give the editor and the company what they want.
Absolutely, that's exactly how it works, and I hadn't quite thought of it like that before. But yeah, they are a second audience, if you like. And so balancing, well, it's three really, because you're writing for yourself as well. So balancing what I thought was a good idea with what the editor thought was a good idea, with what I thought and the editor thought that the reader wanted. Yeah, I know, it's circles and circles and circles. At least when you're writing for your blog, unless you're writing for a sponsor or someone who's actually paying for your content or need that somebody else has, you're writing for yourself, really. But when you're working with other people, especially with an editor, you're writing for more than yourself. At the same time, what the editor wants, you're also thinking about what the reader might want, and the editor thinking about what the end reader might want as well, in terms of not entertainment, but saleability.
Sure, in general, if they like the idea of your book, is looking for how much money can we make out of this, as opposed to a blogger unmonetized who's doing it for the love of it.
It's the difference between something that's creatively satisfying for you and something that might be financially satisfying for the editor. And it's great if those two things mesh up, but when they don't, talking in general, then that's when you run into all sorts of difficulties, I think, working with somebody else whose view might not be the same or whose focus might not be quite the same as what you think would be a good idea.
So did the editor say no to some of the stuff that you wanted? You said some of them weren't included and you thought they were great. How did that happen? How was it presented back to you?
I don't think I ever had a complete knockback of a Lou that I put in there. There were suggestions about others that I could include, and that would then mean to keep the state balance right, that means if I added one here, then I'd have to take one away. The editor might want a particular one for a particular reason. I think there was one that had an emu or something in front of it, and she thought that was really good. So I had to put that one in, and it did look good. That meant I had to take another one out, because otherwise that state would then be too skewed towards a particular state, and that's not what we wanted. If I'm doing that for myself, I would have just put them all in, or put them in whatever configuration I wanted.
Now, you also mentioned that the name name changed. So the marketing group also had a role in the publication of that book. So it wasn't just the editor you were working with. But then you had the other side of it, which is the marketing department wanted to have a foot in the door as well, because they were the ones that would have to present it to places that would buy it to sell. So did you have any creative go in that, or was that something that was also handed back?
Well, that was something that was presented to me. The working title was Where's the Dunny Mate? And I thought that was really good. It was very Australian.
Very Australian.
And maybe that was the problem. It's too Australian. Or maybe there was a book already published some years before that had the word dunny in the title. And I don't know which of those considerations it was, but the marketing people apparently came up with Aussie Loos with Views as having a bit more of a universal appeal than Where's the Dunny Mate. Whether that was the right decision or not, I don't know. I went with that. I didn't fight to have the other title reinstated because I wasn't wedded to it.
Right.
It wasn't my title. It just came up as, I think we were just talking around it, and it's like, oh, you know, Where's the Dunny Mate? And that's kind of stuck as what we would call the book while we were working on it. Definitely the marketing people had a say as well, and I'd never really considered that when we first started working on the book, that would be a contributing factor.
And was there a graphic side saying that this is the layout, these are the photos that are good enough quality, or did that all come through the editor?
It came to me through the editor. There was a graphic designer that worked with the editor.
That's four different people, the editor, the marketer, designer, and you.
Yes, that's right. And so I was shown what the graphic designer had done. I was shown a picture of the cover that they'd come up with, and because I had no better idea, that wasn't my forte, doing layout. I'd done it on my blog. It's a little different, and my blog was quite simple in that respect. I didn't have a complicated template. Like, mine was just, here's some text, here's a photo. Whereas laying out a book is completely different to that. They had to set it out in such a way that it had some appeal, and the photos had to fit with each other. So if there was a double page spread and there was a toilet on one page and a different one on the next page, they had to look okay together. There was a couple of times when I thought, oh, you know, I wouldn't have put those two together like that, but I could see why it worked. The other thing that came up outside of the graphic design was the order in which the toilets appeared. Now, the Explore Australia imprint is about traveling in Australia. So there's books of maps, campsite places that you can go, and they're all in alphabetical order of destination to make it easier to look up, as something that they did. My loos were going to then be in alphabetical order. And to me, that wasn't necessarily the logical way to do it, because I was kind of making a story or a progression. The way I was looking at it was, here's some outback loos. Then we segue into, here's some loos that have murals or pictures or decorations, have interesting architecture. And I was grouping them like that. It made more of a logical flow to me, because it was presenting the different styles of scenery in the scenic public toilet that you'd actually see. The editor came back and said, no, they all be in alphabetical order. I thought, oh, okay. I had highest public toilet, which is on Mount Kosciuszko. And then there was another place in Victoria called Mount Witchyproof. They claim it to be the world's smallest mountain. And because there's no international definition of what is a mountain and what is not, that is accepted around the world.
Australia doesn't have big tall mountains. We're very old.
No, worn away. Even our tallest mountain, people in other countries live much higher than our tallest mountain.
It's a very large hill.
So I had Australia's highest mountain and the lowest mountain in the world. There's a toilet near the top of that. I put them together because I thought it was an interesting juxtaposition. They weren't in alphabetical order that way. They don't appear together like that. Did it make the book better or worse? I can't say whether it did or not.
You obviously had an idea about a story.
Yes.
Where they do it differently and present a toilet with a story, and then you move on to the next one. So was that hard to adapt to?
Not for this kind of book. It took me aback because I hadn't thought of it myself. I hadn't thought of it as being a destination-based book. I'd thought of it as being, as you point out, a storybook. Here's the story of some public toilets in Australia. And in putting it in the orders that I'd considered, it was more of a flow from one type to the next type, and from the highlands to the lowlands, and from the outback to the cities kind of thing. And it wasn't like that in the end book. It is a series of almost separate little little snippets of destinations. And it's just the way it turned out, that was the way that their books template. Were presented. Mm. Yeah. But even though this was more of a gift book than a serious travel manual, like some of their other books were, still the format was going to be the same. And that was not something that I really had a choice about.
That was your first book, so it was a new experience. How did you feel? Don't actually mean about the writing, but one, the idea of I'm going to get a book published, to move into the end product. How did you feel about that at the end as opposed to the beginning?
It was very satisfying to see the first proofs of the book, although I found errors in them.
Steps forward.
I was able to find my own errors and some of the format errors where they put the wrong photo next to the loop. And so these are fixable. I had the opportunity to fix that up. To see the final product and hold it in my hand was very satisfying to me, despite the differences of opinion about some of the things like the layout and the progression of the book. It wasn't a big problem for me when I finally saw the book, because it's like, oh, look, this is what I've done. I've published a book and no one can take that away from me, even if it only sells 3 copies. I've published a book. And so that was the end game for me. I wanted to have that book published, and now it has been. Forevermore, I will be known as Loo Lady or Toilet Girl.
Well, you have an ISBN, the International Numbering Order for Publications. Yeah. So that will always have Marion Halliday right beside that number.
As author of that book, when I started to Google myself, which people tell me is really egotistical.
And stupid to do, because you never know if someone's going to call you a twat.
I don't think I ever did get that. I tell a lie. The book was sent by the publicist, who is person number 5 in the process, but that came after the book was published. She sent it around to a few different publications, and there was a review of it published. Oh gosh, I can't remember whether it was the Australian now or the Sydney Morning Herald, but bigger Australian paper. And the reviewer was obviously used to reviewing books that were a little more highbrow. And so she was a little bit dismissive of my book, but I don't think that was necessarily a negative thing, because in being a little bit dismissive about it, she highlighted the comedy of it. I think she just thought that my writing style for this book wasn't quite
it wasn't a intellectual real travel
enough.
Book.
It wasn't a real travel book, no. But she then went on to say, I think at the end of the review, that it was, yeah, she could see it being a stocking filler or whatever, which was what the publicist was intending to do. It's interesting as well, a number of places where the toilets in the book appeared, the local paper of that place contacted me, or the local radio station. So I did a few local paper and radio interviews for those who were interested, because their place where they lived had been given a voice through my toilet book. An interesting outcome for me, which again, I hadn't expected that. In writing my blog, I wasn't interviewing other people to get quotes for my blog. And certainly for the toilet book, I didn't either. When I was talking to people from country towns or from publications that wanted to feature the book, it's interesting the different perspectives. So yeah, the publicist did a really good job getting the book out there. They say all publicity is good publicity. So even though the Sydney Morning Herald or Australian Review was
flippant about
my little toilet book,
flippant in its own way, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. It got it out there.
I find that really interesting. One, because it isn't a print book as in just words, like a novel. Even to do a small book, you have so many people that are involved in organising the content. Moving on. We've had a conversation about working with an established publishing company. Now we're going to move on to working collaboratively with a co-author through the Hammy process. There's really 2 parts of the Hammy process. So let's first talk about book 1 and how that came about as a collaborative process.
Yeah, that's an interesting process, because Hammy 1 really came about, it wasn't a joke as such, but it was more of a fun project. And once I'd written the first couple of pages, look, here's some characters that could be a book and here's what it could look like. He jumped on that opportunity, because he has always been very keen to write a children's book. And so he immediately could see the possibilities that, hey, we could continue with this. What happened with that first page or two that I'd written? He looked at that and said, actually, I can improve on that. And so he changed it a little. And then I looked at it and said, I could improve on that too. And so it started really evolving. And that would be the word that I would use to best describe our first collaborative writing process as co-authors, a process where the book evolved from the germ of an idea without any forward planning, without any kind of consideration of how it was going to end, and without any real consideration of character development or any of those important things. When we started out, none of that was in our minds.
So it was a back and forth kind of thing. You'd write a bit, he'd write a bit, or he'd change something, you'd edit something.
Pretty much, yeah. And that worked quite well because it was fun. And that's what it was meant to be. We never sat down and thought, oh, suddenly we're going to make a lot of money from this book. Let's take it really seriously. It was never a serious project, except that after we got to a certain point, it's like, we can publish this. With Hammy One, we went down the self-publishing route with Amazon KDP, which is the self-publishing arm of Amazon.com. We realized that it doesn't matter if we don't find a publisher, we can just do it ourselves. And so we had no other considerations where there were five different people and the readers that we were all looking to make sure they were happy with what was coming out. The only people that had to be happy was Peter and I.
You had a third contributor to that book as yes. well. You had an artist.
Yes, Troy Chiho came in as the illustrator. The input that he had was looking at what we had written and then coming up with illustrations that portrayed how he saw those characters. And I love what he'd done. It was great. It really brought the characters to life.
The illustration role was post-story development and the development of the characters.
Oh, definitely. He came in after that as someone that Peter knew who could help illustrate the book. And that's what he did. As to having input into the storyline and the character development, that was Peter and I.
So in looking at the book, then making the decisions where the illustrations were placed, was that something that you both sat down and discussed, or was that an experience that was brought in from doing the magazine into doing the book?
Peter has a lot of experience in graphic design that comes from his work on Globe Rovers magazine. I don't have that experience. I can come in at the back end of that and say, oh, hang on, this bit isn't straight or doesn't look balanced, but I have no experience with putting something together like that. So that was Peter's work with Troy Chiho to make the book look good in terms of visual appeal.
The experience was a little bit like working with the editor in the first Lose With You. It's a similar process. Their expertise.
Their expertise came into play in the graphic design and layout for sure. I have unashamedly no expertise in that area at all, except in a more editor type of role. I was able to have input into it by saying, oh, I think this would look better on this side of the page rather than that side of the page.
Moving on to the second Hammy book, that was a different experience. A book that you both sat down to produce.
That is absolutely correct. It was deliberately made that way because I think from possibly more Peter's point of view than mine, but mine as well, it was a bit too much back and forth with Hammy One. We were floundering around sometimes, like, how are we going to end this bit off? And where's that part of the storyline going? When it came to writing Hammy Two, we took ourselves and our writing a lot more seriously. Peter's work background has been in consumer research, and he's also been involved in the world of academia. He's got a PhD in marketing. His approach to writing anything, really, a magazine article, and in this case, a book, is to structure that from the beginning. You know where it's going, where it's headed, how it's going to turn out. And in his case, with the magazine, you know how many words are going to be in each section because you're the one that has to fit it into a template. Now, I don't have that in my head. I have had, as we discussed, a background in corporate writing, but in more recent times, my big love was the love of telling stories. So my approach to that wasn't so much to have that structure. However, I could see how that would make our life easier. For Hammy 2, the main thing that we started out by doing was to develop a structure for the story. And that was a very detailed structure. So we had each chapter set out and the events and scene and sample dialogue. And then, and only then, did we come to actually writing the book.
Did you have particular roles within that structure?
Yeah, how did that work? It was reasonably easy to divvy up the workload in that context. Yeah, Peter had been to the islands that we write about in the book. Peter has met the Moken people. Peter is the one who encountered, if you like, Lecky the Leech and Sally the Snake and Goggles the Monkey. He was responsible in the first instance for coming up with a structure for the story. So nothing was mutually exclusive. So Peter came up with a structure. I then discussed that with him with text messages and so on and comments. We work with Google Docs so we can both be working on the same document at the same time, but we can also both look at something and add comments or add insights or edit it or whatever, and the other person can immediately see what you've done. With the structure, we both agreed on that as being how it worked, and then my role was to fill in the gaps by writing the book around what was already in that quite detailed structure.
Did you still start at the beginning of the story and work your way to the end, or did you sometimes work in a more unstructured portion?
Yeah, there's always an unstructured portion with me. I mean, even with things like this interview, you and I are the only people in the world who know how much it's been edited. It will remain that way, I hope. The unstructured part of it for me was the creative process. So as I'm writing anything, I let it take me where it takes me. And that's just the way I work. So I look at a piece of the structure and think, okay, I'm writing this scene. And I did do it in a chronological order. I didn't jump around all over the place. So I started at the beginning, worked my way through to the end. But as I was going through that, sometimes a character would say to me something different to what was in the structure. And so I would change that or modify the structure a little bit to incorporate that new thought or to add that new thing. And that's just the way I work creatively.
Interestingly, when you were talking about that Peter's met Peter's been, how much of that did you have to know to write around those experiences of his?
Yeah, that's a good question. Part of that is discussion with him about what this means or what that place looks like. Peter is a photographer as well, so he's taken a lot of photos of the places that he's been to. Peter's shown those places to me in photos and descriptions and stories that he said about this is what happened while I was here.
Did you have a lot of discussion about the culture of the Mokan people?
Not really.
Research?
He has done research around the Mokan people. I haven't. I would take his word for a lot of what was happening with the cultural aspects of it, because I guess I've never even been to Thailand, let alone the Thai islands. So I guess that's one of the big benefits of having a co-author. You both bring different levels of experience and different cultural aspects of that experience to the table. There's things that are in the book that wouldn't be there if Peter hadn't spoken of them, but there's also things that are in the book that probably wouldn't be there if I hadn't known about them. Coming back to your question about the cultural aspects, no, I didn't have any real knowledge and I didn't do any personal research. I relied on what Peter was saying for those parts of the book.
Is that something that's an experience with a co-author as opposed to an editor? An editor has expectations that you'll write well and you'll present them with stuff that they want. With a co-author, you rely not on direction, but the experience of both of you trying to join together to come up with a coherent story.
Yes, that's correct. Also bearing in mind that I guess we both played the editor role to some degree, because Peter wrote the structure and then I edited it, saying, what about this? Or let's do that, before it was agreed to and approved. Once I'd written my part of it, he then took an editor role and said, yeah, I'm not sure about this, or how can that be better? Or I really like this bit. And so the roles kind of blend and merge a little within that structure of having distinct roles.
Because you have a relationship with the story as well as with each other as co-authors, you would become less defined in the roles that you actually participate originally in.
Yeah.
Because you've got to the stage where you should know where each of you are going.
Yeah, and because we had that working relationship to start with, we had become used to working together, even though it was in a different context where he owned the magazine and I was working as an editor. Then we moved into working as co-authors, which was more of an equal relationship. The roles did tend to blur towards the end. But bear in mind, we're both working hard towards the same end game. We both wanted to have a book that we were proud of that was ready for publication, and that's what we ended up.
So how long did that take?
It took quite a long time. I mean, we both have had a number of other projects that we've been working on in the sidelines. I mean, Hammy 1 came out in 2022 and Hammy 2 came out in 2025. We weren't working on Hammy 2 that whole time. It took us quite a while to come up with the storyline for Hammy 2, and it took quite a while longer for that to be written once the structure was approved, and it took quite a while longer for the illustrations to be done. So
because there's more of them.
Oh, there's a lot more of them in Hammy 2, definitely, and they're a lot more comprehensive. They show a lot more detail than the illustrations in Hammy 1, so they required a lot more work. And because the story is actually longer, it required a lot more work to write that as well. Bearing in mind, as I said, we both had other projects that we were working on, so we would take time out to do that. The magazine was still being produced during that time as well, so, you know, it wasn't like we were solely working on Hammy 2 for 3 years.
Some people take 20 years to get to their first novel, but I suppose what we actually have now, and talking about the collaborative process, is we have you working with a publishing house, we have you working organically in the middle, then we have you working towards a structured development of a story. So in tying all of those together, what have you learned about the process of working collaboratively?
Oh, there's so many lessons that I've learned about that. I think one of the key lessons is when working with a traditional publisher was I assumed from day one correctly that they knew what they were doing. They've done that before and I never had. And so I was very open to their suggestions and very open to agreeing with what they said. I think looking back now, if I was to have have that experience again, I'd probably be a little more vocal about some of the things that I thought could have been better. But still, I guess if you're working with people who know what they're doing because they've done it so many times before, then you'd be an idiot not to accept some of their advice. So I would definitely be more vocal about that. In terms of the middle process, where I was working a lot more organically and the book evolved rather than being planned out, I actually didn't mind that. Working with the evolved book as opposed to the planned book is probably closer to my natural working style, but I can see as well the benefits of having the structure there. It certainly made writing Hammy 2 a lot easier in the sense that I knew where the story was going. I could give little hints, if you like, about something that might be happening further ahead in the story and refer back to things that had already been written. Whereas in Hammy 1, I was probably not doing that so much because I didn't know where the story was going to start with. And so that worked quite well. The back and forth without having a clear, this is your role and this is my role, still worked. But if I had my time again, I would probably combine those two approaches a little bit more, the approach of Hammy 1 and Hammy 2. So having a structure, but having the freedom within that structure to let the creative muse take me where it wanted to be without feeling that I had to stick to a structure. But of course, what I would do differently now is have that discussion about our working styles beforehand. When we started Hammy 2, I didn't realize that our working styles were going to be quite different. And so it never occurred to me to have that discussion first and say, well, okay, this is how I'm going to work with this. Is that okay with you? It never occurred to me once. So we didn't have that discussion. And perhaps in retrospect, we should have done. Because then it's clear to everyone who's doing what, how it's going to work, what happens if there's changes to the structure, how do we deal with that? We didn't discuss any of those things to any great degree because I think we both assumed that we knew what the other one was going to do and how they would react.
So basically, communication is the most important thing in terms of partnerships, regardless of whether it's with a publishing company or with a co-author or a co-author and printer of that publication. You've talked about also that you're moving on towards another project, and that is where you're writing alone. Will you take any of the experiences that you've had with the publishing house, self-publishing, and working with people to write that book? So do you think your style has changed because of your previous experience?
Oh, definitely. The thing that I would take from the traditional publishing experience is that writing about something that I know and using my voice to communicate, yes, definitely. I don't know whether my next project will be published by a traditional publisher.
Hopefully.
But yes, what I know now is the different people that are involved in that and how they all work together. So I know about the publicity and I know about how to market the book in a certain way. I know what might appeal to an audience better because I've had that experience. What I would take away from the Hammy experiences, both of them together now, is that I realize now that my process is very much a creative flow rather than a structure, but I can see the benefits of having that structure. So instead of just let's sit down and write a little bit today and see where it takes me, I'm already looking at the structure of my next project before I start any more writing. I've done some writing on it already, but I'm backtracking now and looking at a structure. The other thing that I would do, maybe I wouldn't have done if I hadn't had the Hammy experiences, is ask for other people's opinions much more early in the process. I tend to get my energy from working alone and really getting through and creating something and then presenting it to somebody else and saying, look how good am I? I've done this and isn't it fabulous? Not thinking for 1 minute that they might look at it and think, oh, maybe it's not so fabulous after all. I know my work would benefit more from earlier critique and earlier suggestions from interested parties, or be able to provide some input into that much earlier than my natural inclination would be. My natural inclination would be just let's finish it and show everyone how brilliant I am. But I see now that that's not necessarily going to work best for the project. And knowing now that the end game is, again, to produce a book that I'm proud of, but that has appeal to other people and resonates with other people, especially the experiences I'm going to put in it.
So that means you've learned over that process.
We can only hope that that is what we're saying here.
That creativity is important, but it's important to have an end goal of where that's going to be, as opposed to creativity for creativity's
sake. Yeah. The creativity for creativity's sake is my early natural style of working. Yes, I'm going to write something and I look at it and think, wow, that's good. It doesn't necessarily fit into a structure or fit into a story. And now I recognize that it needs to be able to progress a piece of work to the finish. If it doesn't fit into anything, then however good it is, it shouldn't be there.
So in all, you always work collaboratively when you're wanting a publication to go outside your house and into the world.
I guess that's true, isn't it? I think we've proved that through we've proved that for me at least in the three experiences that we've talked about. Having that end goal of what do you actually want to achieve with this project is probably something that we hadn't specifically touched on. It's a very important part of it as well. That's what I guess was missing in Hammy 1. We didn't set out to write a children's book that was going to be actually published. That's what it ended up being when I wrote that first page. That's not what I was thinking particularly. But yes, having that goal to work towards, as we did with Hammy 2 and as I did with my traditionally published book about toilets, yeah, that helps. You have that idea in your head of this is what I want at the end, and that will colour the way that you work towards it.
I think we've come to the end of the interview in terms of the three series. It's been an interesting and fascinating time looking at your journey from someone who started off as a compositioner to someone who's now published three books and is moving towards the development of a new product, hopefully that we will see sometime in the future. Thank you very much for sitting down with us and revealing so much about yourself and your creativity and the work that you do with others so that we can enjoy your output.
Thanks very much, Jerry, for having me on the podcast. Interestingly, when you say that I've shared so much about myself, I've learned so much about myself just talking in these three podcasts as well. I've clarified in my own head the way that I prefer to work, and then now I'm joining that up with maybe the way that is going to be a more productive way to work in the future. Yeah, I can't thank you enough for having me on board. I hope our listeners have got something out of it as well. Thanks for listening.
And hopefully we'll have you back when you have your next book out.
I'm sure that will happen.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much for listening, everyone. Marion has been fascinating, and hopefully we'll get her on again for different discussions about different aspects of publishing books.
Thanks, Jerry. Bye, everybody.